The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Matt Boone
Media Productions. You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why. Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
Yo. I've been informed that I can't say hey guys any longer because Matt Coon, the funny guy on the show, makes fun of me. So I'm not going to say hey guys. So I'm starting it off today with yo. Matt, what is going on, bro?
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey, Matt Coon here. You just wanted to steal it from me.
Hey, Robbie, there is so much going on, dude. First of all, let's go ahead and fill everybody in. What a great show we had last week. And also, our cherry bonus episode dropped on our podcast platforms. So we had a lot of people listening this week. What's the feedback you got from Matt Morgan?
A lot of people are saying how they're so surprised that he's probably the only guy in wrestling who has turned down wanting to give their contact information out to do wrestling appearances. I think that's going to be our one and only, Matt.
What a fascinating figure Matt Morgan is, because he's smart, he's just gigantic, he had charisma, he just walked away. And also, we dropped our cherry episode, which is a bonus for getting 500 YouTube subscribers.
It was great. I'm glad people finally got to hear her story, because, I mean, everybody knows she's a good friend of mine. And, you know, she had a rough run there in WWE at the end, so I'm glad she got to share her story, clear the air, make herself feel a little better. And hopefully it opens up some new Twitter followers for her and some bookings and stuff. But, you know, like we said, we dropped it on YouTube. We gave you guys a little something extra. But, of course, we're going to put it on iTunes and everywhere else you get our podcast from, so everyone could get the opportunity to listen at some point.
Do we want to talk about some feedback we got from the cherry episode that we got on Twitter? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Cliff Compton responded, and apparently I didn't hear anything that Cherry said that was that crazy or that out of the ordinary. But Cliff has said that what she said was a bunch of fiction. Did you see that tweet?
Yeah, you know, I don't. I can't say I know them both. Cliff's a good dude too, so I don't know the story either way. But yeah, there didn't seem much in there where it would have been something big that someone was lying about. But you know, everyone has their own version and their own experience with a situation, so both of them might be right.
Well, you know, I'll say this much: Cliff Compton, who's Domino Cliff Compton at Cliff Compton on Twitter, has an open invitation to be on Why It Ended to clear the air and tell his side of the Deuce, Domino, and Cherry situation. Don't you think?
Yeah, plus, I mean, he's had a great wrestling career anyway, so he'd be a cool person to talk to.
Absolutely, and we are going to be in Chicago for All In Weekend. What do you think about us being a big part of StarCast?
Well, I mean, as you can see, clearly it's shaping up to be possibly one of the biggest wrestling weekends in history, and I don't mean that by numbers. I just mean that by buzz. Everybody is talking about it. I think every wrestling fan right now is talking about All In. It's going to be huge, so why wouldn't one of the hottest podcasts out there be a part of it, Matt? I mean, we're a thing now. You get it? We're a thing.
It's totally crazy, and when you see what we're going to do, it's even going to be crazier. It's a whole weekend of events. It starts on Thursday. On Thursday night, you might actually see me play some music with Frankie Kazarian and the Young Bucks dad, Papa Buck. And then over the weekend, there might be some Why It Ended guests and some Why It Ended merch. And on Sunday, Why It Ended is the ending of StarCast. We're the last event. So much going on right now. We have our Pro Wrestling Tees store open, which is prowrestlingtees.com/whyitended. You can get a Muhammad Hassan style shirt, a Glacier style shirt, a smooth, silky, chocolatey voice style shirt, and of course, my favorite shirt, Robbie. Do you like our new shirt?
The Buff Bagwell shirt has been like, I've already got like 20 people hitting me up within like a day saying that they've ordered it already. So I think that's going to be our big one.
Yeah, for sure. And also make sure to check us out on YouTube and make sure to, which is at whereitended.com. And if you want to listen to us, whyitended.com or iTunes, give us a 5-star review. What else you got going on these days, Robbie?
Well, this weekend, I actually... I'm headed to Nashville, Tennessee, to the fairgrounds for a show that I'm looking forward to a lot. It's their second show, and it is for Overdrive Pro Wrestling. And here's the deal. As much as I think it's a great growing promotion with a hell of a bunch of talent on it, and let me just tell you, some of that talent includes this Saturday Austin Aries, myself, Colt Cabana, Rock and Roll Express, Jazz, James Ellsworth. It's going to be a huge show. But let me just make something clear, and this is a warning, because I know the promoter of that show is listening, and I know Terry Reynolds is listening. If I don't get put in the main event this Saturday, there's going to be hell to pay to Terry Reynolds, all right? Because she's the commissioner there, and there's going to be big problems. That's all I'm saying, Matt.
Well, I'm sorry I can't help you out with that. Terry's really nice, but I don't think she's going to listen to me. We work together, but Terry actually brought us together, so maybe she will listen to you. What are you prepared to do if you're not put in the main event, Robbie?
I'm going to do whatever I have to do. Remember that guy Farouk back in the day? That guy? Remember when he used to say, by any means necessary? Yeah. That's what's going to go down this Saturday at the Fairgrounds in Nashville.
Well, this is Overdrive Wrestling, Overdrive Pro Wrestling, and it is in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You definitely want to check it out. The Belt Collector, Austin Aries, a bunch of other people. But I want to see the confrontation between my old podcast partner and the person who introduced me to Robbie and Robbie E. But hopefully she knows better and puts you in the main event, dude.
Yeah, well, time will tell.
Time will tell for sure. And speaking of time, we have some time coming up to listen to somebody named Al Snow. What is it about Al that made you want to have him on the program, Robbie?
Well, for the fact that his relationship with Mick Foley, that's kind of like how Mick always kind of picks on him. That's been my relationship with him for the past, 7 or 8 years. He pretty much will make fun of me at any chance he gets to play a joke on me or embarrass me in front of a large group of people. That's kind of his MO.
So coming up today, not only do we have Al Snow, but we have a follow-up interview with someone who's going through some struggles right now, our good friend, Justin Credible. What do you think we're going to hear from Justin?
I've been hearing a lot of things, good things, bad things, good things, bad things, good things, bad things. It seemed to change by the day. So I just hope he's in a good place, and we're going to find out.
Well, I talk to him all the time, and he really wants to tell his story and give us an update. So I will say that I'm suspecting what we're going to hear is kind of unpleasant, but at the same time, this is something that our friend PJ, Justin, wants to share with everybody. So that's going to be coming up today as well. So we're going to hear from Justin first, and then our feature interview with Al Snow on Why It Ended. Joining us this week for a follow-up interview to a show we did a couple weeks ago, we have our good friend, Justin Credible. How are you doing today there, Justin?
I'm doing good, guys. I mean, I'm hanging in there. Unfortunately, since last time we spoke, a little bit of bad news. But other than that, my wife has some issues with cancer. But anyways, I don't want to get caught up in that. I'm just saying, other than that, things are okay.
Has anything new been going on with you?
Dude, I'm a fuck up. I'm sorry. I don't know what the language I'm allowed to use. I'm hit and miss. I'm hit and run. I didn't drink today. I drank yesterday. I didn't drink the day before, but I drank 2-3 days in a row the day before. So, like, I'm trying, man. I'm trying so fucking hard. Obviously, you could hear by the difference of my tone right now that I'm in a better place right now, But nonetheless, I'm really trying. Dude, I really want to be sober. I mean, I truly, it's just like, I just feel like life is kicking me in the ass 24/7. And I got this movie, I got heat for it, guys. Oh, by the way, Robbie, I wanted to tell you, I got heat for saying something about how I felt about the promoters or the
guys that you didn't trust them.
Fucking don't trust them. They're pieces of shit. Dude, they haven't fucking done. Sorry, super shoot. I shouldn't have gone there. But it's like totally wrong. I don't trust them, no. Every week they promised me something. I signed a contract. They promised me something. And trust me, brother, it was nothing. I mean, really nothing. Like $500 a week, nothing. I mean, don't get me wrong. And to, I mean, you say that to people, like $500 a week, well, it's a lot of money. After 25 years in the business, to make a movie about my life and expose my children and my family, I don't think that's a lot. So, anyways.
Is the movie completely not happening now?
Oh, no, it's happening. Oh, it's happening. No. We're finishing wrapping this week. So what we're trying to do is this weekend, actually, we will finish 18th, 19th, and 20th. We will finish production on The Uncredible. I did not want this show to be booked. It was booked by somebody else. We're changing some things around, but no, the film's definitely it's dude, and they spent enough money on it. They put at least 50, 60 G's into it, so at least in my payoff they did. So, and God bless me. But you know, all kidding aside, I wasn't mentally, and I talked to Dallas Page about this. Dally, I said, hey, dude, I'm overextended. I can't handle it, dude. Like, just, you know what I'm saying? The mental, the physical, you know, all the bullshit that goes with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm trying to do this right. Like, this is, like, you don't get it. Like, how many people get a fucking documentary, right? So you want, I mean, as much of a, it's your fuck-up story, but hopefully it's your redemption story, hopefully, sure. Right? It's still, to Robbie, Matt, it's still, we don't know, I don't know where the fuck this is going to end up. I could still fuck up, dude. So, again, I mean,
we all want to see a story with a happy ending, you know, and that's how the movie might work.
Well, I want you to. Trust me. I mean, my family and my kids, especially with what's going on with my wife. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get emotional, but, you know, I just want to do good. I just want a good representation of what I was, what I did, and what the journal, you know, and if I could help somebody, you know what, I want to be able to help somebody. That's, you know, that's what the Brian James from the Dogs talks to me all the time, fucking buries me with this shit. He's like, yo, you gotta give it away to keep it. Basically meaning, you know, you gotta help others to help yourself.
You know, it seems to me that if you want to help other people, it's time to get the help for yourself and kind of really get the treatment that you need. I don't think you're going to be able to do it on your own. I don't think the movie is going to help you. I know you're going through a lot of, you know, really intense stuff with your wife right now. But I think, you agree it's kind of maybe time for you to get this thing taken care of and to get into a in-person rehab situation?
I would gladly do it, dude, but there's so much financial into this right now that it will pretty much bankrupt my whole family.
You're talking about the movie?
Yeah, dude.
But PJ, isn't the movie wrapping this week?
Yeah, on the 20th.
So what about, you don't think the 20th or
after that, I'm done. After that, I'm done, dog. I'm done, yeah, then after that. But again, how do I send myself away with somebody who's dying? But how do you process that, you know? Not knowing the amount of time you have with the woman you love. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not an easy decision. And I get it. Wow, sorry, dude. I got to get my balls up. Sorry, dude.
Well, it's totally understandable. I'm sorry.
I apologize. I'm trying to get my balls up, dude. I'm not trying to be a little pussy. I don't even know what's politically correct to fucking say anymore. But anyways, I know I need help, but I can't leave her with the kids. Are you fucking kidding me? Are you kidding me? you know, like, wow, this is too intense, dude. Wow, I was not ready for this. Wow. Anyways, I'm just saying, it's just hard. And I really kind of need a buddy system here, with sober friends that will help me. I don't think I need a medical detox. I honestly don't feel that way. I could be wrong. I'm not a fucking doctor. But that being said, I just need some really good sober buddies in the business. And Sean Waltman's been one of them, dude. He's almost like, dude, he's like, he kicks my ass. Like, he'll call bullshit. Like, he'll call it spade a spade. I don't know if you guys know Sean very well, but Sean will fucking just tell you, you're full of shit, Paige. Fuck you, you know? And I'm sorry, I don't know if I use language on your show.
No problem.
I'll try not to. But yeah, dude, it's like one of those things where it's like, he'll call it, you know, and I need people like him in my life. I need people in my life that are going to help me. Just kind of steer the path.
Well,
so PJ, I got to ask you, because after the last time that you were on our show, you had said something about, you know, where all the bodies are buried in Stanford. And like, Matt, I know you get a lot of tweets about this too. So many people have wanted you to elaborate on that more. What does that mean? Like, what are the bodies that are buried in Stanford? Could you explain?
Oh, again, I know where the bodies are buried, dude. I'm sorry, that's just all you can say. I just know where the bodies are buried. I can't go any further. I can't go any, there's no less, no more. I mean, there's no bodies, but it's like, I know the dirty deeds, the dirty, you know, the dirty, the secrets, the bad, you know what I mean?
No, I understand what you want. I think people just wanted specifics, but I understand if you don't want to give them.
You know, there's a code of ethics. Dude, there are things I can say, and I will say someday, of things that I've done. Dude, it's such a fucking story. I mean, I've gone all around the world with fucking cocaine in my fucking nutsack, traveling to the fucking Middle East for the top guys, fucking, you know, like, FedExing shit to the fucking agents in the fucking company, you know. Everybody had to have their fix. And I did what I could do to help the boys, because we were all the boys, right? That's what the boys do, right, Robbie?
Of course. Yeah, you got to help each other, bro.
I was just helping in my stupid fucking mind. I was helping the boys. And again, I won't go any further because I don't want to go down that trail someday.
Well, at the time, you don't realize the stuff you're doing and how crazy it is. It's like no different. I think back of stuff that I did, maybe not on that level, but, you know, just so many things I think of that I'm like, God, I was so dumb for doing it. And it's just, it's wrestling. You're just, your mind's at a different place.
We only have a couple minutes left, so I just want to ask you one more question, Justin. Is that, you know, your wife going through what she's going through and you can't leave, but what can you do in these months that your wife has to give her the best Justin that you can give her?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know. It's something that we're honestly right now. She just came out here and gave me like kind of like a shot in the shoulder, you know, because there's shit going on, and it's very intense, man. It's very intense. It's very intense, and it's just really, it's like, it's not, dude. I have no answers. You know, I'm not victimizing anybody or any, no bullshit like that. I'm just saying, dude. One day, and it sounds so fucking corny, but literally one day at a time.
Yeah.
All I can guarantee you, dude, Robbie, Matt, you know, that's all I can guarantee you.
You know, I'm always a phone call away. Robbie's always here, and we'll continue this. We'll stay around, and we'll find, you know, we'll stay in touch, and definitely let us know what's going on. And
yeah, please. Please. And can I be half as good looking as Robbie?
Come on.
Could I be like a quarter of his good looking? Dude, like really, dude?
How much?
Like Robbie and Matt, thank you guys so much. I'm sorry if I was a little too much, but I appreciate the time and the attention and, just keep the calls up, dude. You know, thank you. Appreciate y'all. Seriously.
So we just heard from Justin Credible. Sometimes the updates we get aren't all good news, but we're always going to check up with people. It's good to hear from our guests and create these relationships with these great wrestlers, isn't it, Robbie?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, he's on here and there's a lot of unfortunate things going on in his life right now. But the good news is that we have thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners weekly that are hearing this. And I know you're like, well, why would, you know, people want to hear this story? You might be thinking, but there's someone out there that can reach out and help him. You know, I think that. I think his fans getting behind him and his fans tweeting him and sending him messages to stay positive, I think that will help him. And they're learning about this situation through this show. So whether he's on here being negative or positive, I think in the long run, it's helping people learn his story and be able to get behind him.
Well, you know, and while you're at it, why don't you go ahead and reach out yourself and let our friend Justin Credible at PJ Polacco on Twitter, let him know how you feel about him and let him know you're rooting for him. I believe the man's got it in him to create a great life for himself, and maybe we can all be part of that journey. And coming up now, our feature interview this week with the one and the only Al Snow on Why It Ended. And joining us right now, one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, Al Snow. Al, thanks for being here. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on the show. And if I were doing any better, I'd be jealous of myself.
Hey, well, Al, I just wanted to say thank you for being on. This is straight from me, your buddy Robbie E. And I also wanted to let everyone listening know, and Matt, I wanted you to know that everything Al says about me throughout this interview is not true.
Yeah, that's true. He's very intelligent. he's very talented. He's very well built. He's muscular. He's attractive. You're right. None of it's true.
How are you that quick? He's always that quick, and I never got it. Like, what it goes through your mind that you're just able to fire back so soon?
Well, it's called an IQ.
Okay.
You might want to try it. It would make you quick, too. And I know when you're swimming laps in the water doing your workouts, okay? I mean, like quick-witted, as opposed to dim, like dim-witted, like you are.
Hey, just a reminder, I was a school teacher, I have a college degree, and I host a podcast. Just throwing that out there.
Much to the tragedy of America. Yes.
Okay, well, me and you could banter on later, but let's get right into it. What year was it, how old you are, and how did you fall in love with pro wrestling?
When I originally fell in love with pro wrestling would have been back in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was just a child. And the original Sheik's territory, big time wrestling, aired on TV, 76. And somewhere in there, we got WTBS, Turner Broadcasting, and Georgia Championship Wrestling. And then it was like, that was it. Like, you know, I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lima, Ohio. It's about an hour south of Toledo and an hour north of Dayton. It's out in the middle of nowhere. The only, just south of that was the hometown for Neil Armstrong. I'm sure you're not aware of this, but he was the first man on the moon, Robbie. And
you know, just to cut you off there for a second, when you just said that, I said, is he a singer or is he the guy that was on the moon? And that was, cool. I was really just going through my head right now.
Color me shocked.
And you mentioned Georgia, and that's maybe your first foray into the world of wrestling, which was with a camp with Ole and Gene Anderson. What was that experience like? First of all, seeing the guys you've seen on TV actually working with them. And then also, much has been made about their training style. What was your experience working with the Anderson brothers?
I have to set the stage. Wrestling was a very closed, very secular business back then. It was easier to be a made man in the mafia than it was to be a professional wrestler. And even worse, you know, here I am. I started at 16. You know, I'd get the magazines. I'd see, oh, well, Crockett's promotions in North Carolina, in Charlotte. I'd make a long-distance call. And G was like, yeah, we're going to have a tryout in October. It's $250 a person, which back in 1981, $250 is a lot of money.
Hell yeah.
You get down here, you pay $250, you can try out. If you, you make it through the tryout, you will train you. I'm like, oh, this is it, you know. So prior to that, I had, they had, at my local high school, ran a wrestling show. One of the teachers had given me the business card of Jim Lancaster, a journeyman wrestler, and been working for probably 10, 15 years and was kind of going into semi-retirement. Convinced me not to do it, you know, not to go in the wrestling business. And I told him about Gene Anderson. He said, well, when you get down there, tell him I said hi. I said, okay. Basically took a bus ride on a Greyhound bus, which is cruel and unusual punishment for anyone. Showed up, and there was probably 35, 40 guys there. Oh, he's like, let's get going. Out we go. We do a 5-mile loop around the back parking lot of the Charlotte Coliseum.
Oh, boy.
Now some guys start to drop off. We come back in. We're going to do 500 Hindu squats. Some more guys drop off. Now you got to go run the stairs in between the seats. Up, back down, over, up, back down, over, up, back down, over, all the way around. Got to do 400 push-ups. Don't care how you do them. Don't care how long it takes you. Even if you just got to pick yourself up and fall to the floor, you're doing 400 push-ups. So, you know, they're blowing you up, you know, so that you're easy to handle, easy to deal with. Which I understand why they were doing it. It's because, one, you're easier to physically manage. And two, you know, if you leave there, you know, they go, oh, wrestling's fake. Hey, I tell you, wrestling's fake. Hey, man, I had to go through hell. So it served its purpose, and I understand why they were doing it. So when it was your turn, which was mine, finally, and I get in the ring, always screaming at me, yelling at me, I'm all completely, I'm just in shock, really. Tells me to get down on all fours. The first guy gets down, and Ole says, get set. And he goes, go. And, you know, I get out from underneath the guy, and I get away from it. I do this, you know, and each time I'm getting more and more exhausted, and, like, literally I'm on all fours, and my arms are shaking, my chest is shaking, my legs, I mean, they're just quivering from exhaustion. I get through four of the guys. Last guy's probably 280. He gets me down, clamps me in the rear chin lock. I get up on all fours again. Ole gets mad at him, starts screaming at him, tells him to do it again. Now I'm really completely exhausted. Gets me down, gets me in a rear chin lock. I'm trying to get back to all fours. Ole's in my face screaming, you know, call me Columbus, because that was the only town he could remember out of Ohio. They keep going, you want to go home, Columbus? You want to go home? And I'm like, I probably would have said, yeah, but I had my mouth clamped shut because the guy had me in a rear gin lock. So he took that as I didn't want to give up. So at this point, that's when Ole would then take over, and he would basically hook you because he was a sadistic prick, and he would hook you or stretch you, and he would hurt you. One of the guys he had rear chin locked and had held on to him and broke his jaw and had knocked him unconscious. And was, you know, screaming at him and asking if he'd give up. And then the other guys were like, the trainees were like, sir, he's out, he's out. And he had blood pouring out of his mouth. And so Gene rolls in the ring. Now, Gene's not a hooker, he's not a shooter, but he was a nasty piece of work. I get down again, all fours, and I'm just shaking. And then Ole screams, go. And as soon as he screams, go, Gene starts pulling my hair, literally scratching my eyes, fish hooking my mouth where, you know, he's tearing his nails across my gums and splitting my lips, and slams my face into the bottom rope, breaks my nose. Apparently, I found out later, and when I got to the room and looked in the mirror, I had bite marks all over my back where he had been biting me. But I had my adrenaline was so high, I didn't ever even feel it. All of a sudden, he reaches for my nuts. And thank God, they just kind of shifted to one side and he grabbed them. So I thought, okay, and I grabbed his and held on for dear life. And we just kept rolling back and forth, and he's hitting me and fish hooking me and raking my face. And then he rolls me over on my back, and he has his thumb in my eye, and he's screaming, do you want to lose your eye? Do you want to lose your eye? Now Ole's the voice of reason and walks over and, hey, break it up, break it up. Pulls Gene off, Gene Sellin, for what I've had latched onto his nuts, only kicks me in the ass and tells me to get the fuck out of the ring. I go back to the back, clean myself off, come out, shake their hand, because I'm not going to put them over, and ask what time the show was that night. Used the last little bit of money I had to buy a ticket that night to the show. That was the night that Piper worked with Greg Valentine in a dog collar match and lost a piece of his ear. I sat there and watched the show, and then got up the next morning and made the very painful 5 or 6 mile walk back to the bus station. Took a horrible 24-hour bus ride back home. Couldn't walk up the stairs to go to the bathroom, so I had to sleep on the couch and would pee in a milk jug and reset my nose on the bus. Got in contact with Lancaster, who then decided that he wanted to train guys and have his own crew. He was running a show. You know, the story continues from there. It was not a straight line. Lancaster, and then had my first match, which was a 20-ring, two-man, over-the-top rope battle royal in Springfield, Ohio.
What did you wear for your first match? Like, what gear did you have back then? Did you have any yet?
I had of course. You didn't get in the ring without gear. Not like it is today. a very ugly Tarzan singlet. some patent leather white boots.
Were you super nervous? Like, you waited so long and went through so much. Like, did it hit you before you went out?
No, I knew that was what I wanted to do.
So looking back at your experience with the Andersons, that just sounds like the worst time and something that maybe could push someone who wasn't as motivated away from it. But
it's meant to, and there's a reason why. And that is because it only takes one person to kill the business. It only takes one person to destroy everyone's hard work and effort. This was what they did for a living. This is how they fed their families. And they didn't have an alternative. Most of those guys could not fit in regular society. Once you got in, they would torture you, not just physically. Physically was easy. They would torture you mentally and emotionally. They would twist you up just to see if they could crack you and send you home. It was a game for them. And it was entertainment.
But as a teacher, and as someone who takes teaching very seriously, and you think about it a lot, and you're very good about talking about it.
Yeah.
Looking back, do you think that was their motivation? Or do you think it was a mixture of that, sadism, and conning people out of money? Because it doesn't seem to me like they had this, altruistic desire to help the wrestling business as much as they did a desire to kick the crap out of people and take their money.
And probably, yeah, it would be both. You know, it served two purposes. One was, they got to make some money, and that's really all they cared about. So they got a good payday. The second reason is that, because they figured we'll fleece the marks. All these guys are calling us up and wanting to get in the business, but we're going to make some money for our time, and we're going to make sure that when they leave, they're going to put the business over to everybody else.
Hey, not counting me, how often do you walk into locker rooms and look at the guys and say and just basically say that they would not have survived back in the day in locker rooms?
Plenty, and that's not a put down, and it's not.
So you said something earlier that rings really true about really any profession, that it's never a straight line. You definitely did not take a straight line. We're talking about 1982, and the first time a lot of us became aware of you was in ECW in 1995. But in 1995, you get your first break, in WWF. Of course, you did some preliminary stuff, wrestling guys like Jannetty and The Undertaker under a different name. But now, because of your experience training people, because of all the training you've had over all these years, this non-straight line, you have this kind of martial arts pedigree, and you're put in these gimmicks like Avatar and Shinobi. What was it like, and when did you first get the call that you were going to be called up, and when you were told you were going to be a ninja?
If I knew then what I know now, I would have been able to more properly capitalize on the opportunity. But there were a lot of things stacked against me. I came from Smoky Mountain, where the rings were completely different. The ropes were steel cable. I could literally, and I'm not exaggerating, I could do 450s. I could do I got to the point where I could stand on the ring apron and in the center of the ring on the outside, spring up, turn in midair, land on the top rope, and moonsault in, land on my feet or hit a splash. Vince is expecting or wanting me to do that kind of stuff, and I get up there for the first match, and the ropes are just like rubber. They're just loose, and they won't hold my weight. They won't support me. And I've got to change my whole style.
Was there anybody guiding you or instructing you through this process?
No. And I spent, 13, 14 years, 12, 13 years there. And nobody, when you go to the ring, nobody would talk to nobody. I'd show up and I didn't know who I was working with, a lot of times. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what we were doing, why we were doing. I'd do pre-tapes, no direction, nothing. They didn't tell you anything.
Was that a reflection of your spot on the card? Do you think they focused more on the guys, more on the top? Or do you think that was something that was consistent through the company?
I'm sure that they did focus more on the guys on the top. But no, that was kind of what they've done with everybody from top to bottom. They don't really communicate any direction. They just come in and, hey, so-and-so's over. You're up this time or, 6 minutes. And they just walk off.
Hey, real quick, Al, just to go back to the Avatar thing, when you got the opportunity to do it, and that was pretty big for you at the time, did you feel when it didn't work that, maybe I blew my chance and I won't have another one? Like, were you down on it or were you still hopeful?
I didn't get down on it or anything until I got the run with Marty Jannetty, and Marty's heart wasn't really into it. And so it went nowhere, and then Marty left, and then that was when I was right back where I started from. And really, again, a lot of that was my own fault. It got to a point where I had a match with Flash Funk at a pay-per-view. Apparently it made an impression, and Shawn Michaels comes back and tries to talk to me at Raw, and I have such a bad attitude that I don't listen. I just sit there and run my mouth, and he gives up and walks away, and Bruce Pritchard comes in and tries to talk too, and I just keep running my mouth, and he just gives up and walks away, and then I kind of just stay there in that spot. And then that was when I tried to quit. I needed to go somewhere and get myself over. I needed them to see me as a star on somebody else's TV.
At the time, you had an attitude. You fucking knew everything. Shawn Michaels trying to talk to you. And so how much of that at the time was when you left to learn how to get yourself over, was it like these people don't see how great I am, and you still just had an attitude about that you were owed more than you got?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was 100% of it. I didn't come from nowhere, and I got myself over to the point to where I got there. Nobody got me over. I got me over.
So from here, how did this end up leading you into ECW?
Well, Chris, at the time, unbeknownst to everybody, Paul was working in conjunction with Vince a little bit secretly, and Chris Candido, God love him, Chris was there one day at TV, and I was like, Chris had same thing. Chris was very frustrated, quit. I talked to Chris, and I said, I got to get out of here. I said, I tried to quit, and they won't let me. I said, man, look, maybe talk to Paul, see if, I can, come over there. So he went and talked to Paul. Paul went to talk to Bruce, and, Bruce talked to Vince, and they basically put me on loan. I was still under contract to WWF at the time, but I went to ECW and went there with the sole purpose that I was going to try to get myself over to where either Paul would pay to keep me, Eric Bischoff would pay to steal me, or Vince would pay to get me back.
And you were kind of the hot indie guy before there was hot indie guys. Like, a lot of us had heard your name before we saw you wrestle, and you hadn't really found a way to monetize that until you got to ECW, where you learned how to, I guess, as you say, I'm just a fan, but as you say, get over. But you did it using what has worked for a lot of people. You found a gimmick that worked for you. How important was the need to find the gimmick, and how important was that overall head gimmick for you to find the fame that you got?
It's essential. It's the secret to success. You have to, let's make something clear. Number one, the audience will never believe in what you do. They don't pay a ticket to believe in your moves. They pay to believe in, and they always have, and they always will, in who you are and why you do what you do. They need to be able to describe you to their friends and family in a sentence or less. They need to be able to turn to their friends and go, you got to watch this show. There's this guy. He's A, B, C, D, E. And if they can't do that, it doesn't matter how good you are, because to be quite honest, and it'll sound like I'm bragging, but you got to understand, when I broke into the business, business was full of hookers and shooters. Hookers are not prostitutes, Robbie. I know that you are hopeful.
So what? Okay, I was going to say, what is a hooker?
A shooter was an amateur wrestler, a guy that had a legit background, and he would shoot in on you, take you down, tie you up. A hooker, they were nasty. They were catch wrestlers. They would catch a hold. They'd catch a joint. They'd hook you. They'd hook holds on you to punish you and to break you. I made a hell of a lot more money walking around acting crazy and shaking a plastic head than I ever did standing on the middle of the ring apron, jumping up and springboarding, turning a 180, laying 2 feet on the top rope and moonsaulting into the ring.
You did not want to go back because you were so over in ECW. They brought you back. When you first came in back in 1998, and you know, you're Al Snow now, you're the guy who got over, you're the guy who is seen as the star, you're everything you wanted to be. When you went back, was it more of the same, or do you think you were looked at a little bit differently?
I was looked at differently, but again, I made more of the same mistakes. I hadn't learned. I didn't understand. That was the biggest sin, is that I went back and I didn't understand how over I was. I didn't appreciate what I was, you know, what an attraction I was. And as a result, again, I went into the, hey, I want to have good matches. Hey, I want to, you know, do that kind of thing, as opposed to having matches that continued to build me and make me look like a star.
I still can't believe there's two different kinds of hookers. That's just...
Yeah. Anyway. You know, thank God you're here. I gotta tell you, man.
You have made some mistakes, or at this point, you know, you had made some mistakes. You had gone to ECW, you've gotten over, you've come back to WWE. They kind of get you a little bit more, but you're still kind of immature, maybe taking things for granted. What about your dream of your dream, that childhood dream? Were you, did you still want that world championship? Did you still see yourself as a big time wrestler?
I never had that dream. I wanted to be a wrestler, you know? I never had that dream that everybody, oh, I want to be in WWE. When I broke in, you wanted to just be a wrestler. You wanted to be the guy. You know what I mean? You want to be a champion? Yeah, that was part of it. But my goals when I broke in, quite honestly, when I got smartened up and I broke in, were, and this is the truth, and I tell people all the time, my goal was to be able to do what I wanted to do for a living, make good money at it, be able to have matches that people would remember, and then make a name for myself that would last beyond when my career ended. You know, people can debate with me, but I think I've done all those.
So a question that you've probably been asked a bunch of times in the past, but Kennel in a Cell Match, was it called, with Pepper the Dog, right? Was that the name of it?
Kennel from Hell Match, yes.
Kennel from Hell, yeah, that's it. Kennel from Hell Match. When you first hear that this is happening, what is your first take on it?
First take on it, and this, I swear to, on my children's lives. First take, Vince Russo, here's what we want to do. I've just watched, Son of Sam, where he talks to a dog. I want you to, you know, we were going to have you talk to Lurawa. Oh, okay. Yeah, we're going to go to this match. And I'm like, okay. Well, I never would say no. Okay. First off. Secondly, the minute he gets done, I go, that's fine, Vince. But we have to have, listen very carefully, we have to have trained animals. Do you understand? Oh, yeah. No, you. I remember this conversation as clear as a bell. And Bruce Pritchard made some remark on his podcast just a couple of days ago, which, because I'm an easy target, you know. I don't have a stroke, so he doesn't have to worry about it. But, you know, he's like, you know, Al Snow's defending himself. And trust me, I'm not defending myself in that match or Boss Man, because it was our job to take, basically, the number one rule in wrestling is take shit and make shoe polish. Okay? But we literally spent months, guys, months making the gimmick of the match, the crux of the entire story, that the culmination of all of these events would lead to Bossman and I in a cell with a cage over that cage, and inside that cage that was outside our cage were going to be these rabid Rottweilers who were basically circling around inside that cage like sharks. And you had to, you know, and they were the gimmick on the pole match. You know what I mean? You can't have the gimmick on the pole match if you ain't got a fucking pole. So
that sounds like an amazing fucking match, Al. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, you spent months selling to an audience that it's just all about the dogs. And I say repeatedly every week at TV, this I swear to you, as God is my witness, every week, we're going to have trained dogs, right? We're going to have trained dogs. We're going to have trained dogs. You know we have to have highly trained dogs that operate on a verbal command, all of them from the same kennel, and the trainer outside the cage. Yes, yeah, we do, Al. Yeah. You mentioned that last week. Yeah, I mentioned it again this week. You sure? We got it? Yeah. Okay, next week. Hey, you know we're going to have trained dogs, right? Because listen, guys, even people in porn know you can't work with children or animals. So guess what I'm going to do? Now, what do? We show up in Charlotte, North Carolina. And again, I'm not defending this. It was Bossman and I's responsibility to take shit and make shoe polish. And regardless of what the platform is, but you've got the entire crux, the entire gimmick of the match, these dogs that you've sold. Okay? And the audience has bought it. They're paying to see it. And I show up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there are eight dogs with eight different owners because they waited till that very day to call a veterinarian clinic to get a list of owners who had Rottweilers. I find out later that they had one guy with one Rottweiler that was trained. That was not what they sold. They sold eight. So
all these dogs aren't trained.
To the point to where
I'd have been so scared. It's not
go out. No, they were out there shitting, pissing, and fucking to the point to where they couldn't show them on TV, and we couldn't interact with them at all.
That is awesome.
So now, of course, everybody throws the heat on me because, again, I'm the whipping boy, and it's an easy shot to take because, you know, we don't want to take it and actually stand up and go, well, yeah, we kind of dropped the ball. We should have probably gotten trained animals. We knew that we were going to do this for months, and we should have made sure that we had 8 or 10 dogs all verbally commanded, you know, where that I've seen them with Rottweilers and with, you know, Doberman Pinschers, where they just say a word, and these dogs do exactly what they're told when they're told. And they could have had the trainers positioned outside the cage, but, you know, setting orders. And if they just had attacked, these dogs would have been rabid and would have been, you know, running around there ready to chew an arm off. And that would have been more terrifying. These dogs were to the point to where we couldn't even show them on TV. But then, of course, hey, yeah, it's Al's fault. You know, let's make fun of Al because, you know, it's easy. And Al ain't got no, you know, Al ain't got no strokes, so he's not going to affect my career, so I can make any comment I want to make.
And this is the payoff to a match in which the angle included...
A payoff to a month-long angle where he kidnapped my dog...
And you ate it.
Then fed it to me.
You know, I have a 5-pound chihuahua named Prancer.
Yeah, I know you do.
I'm afraid of all animals. I don't like when they touch me or get their hair on me or lick me.
Well, it's funny because I spoke to Prancer the other day on the phone, and she doesn't like you or trust you either, and doesn't like your hair getting on her.
All right. All right. Back on track here. Somebody that a lot of people associate you with is Mick Foley. And do you think your presence in his book hurt you and the way that you're viewed in the eyes of wrestling fans, even though it was just a rib?
It didn't. It doesn't hurt me because, like, a lot of people don't understand the difference between being put over or being buried. To bury someone is quite honestly the term is just like when somebody dies. You put them in the ground, you bury them, and then you never speak of them again. That's to bury somebody. The more you talk about somebody, even if it's in a negative light, the more you're bringing attention to them, the more you're putting them over. You're telling the audience to pay attention to them. And so from that standpoint, Mix, you know, put me over a lot. Did it create a certain perception of me and my career because of his incessant ribbing in the book? Absolutely. Yeah. It certainly has. But is it something that has, you know, to the point to where it's, you know, dug a hole and thrown me in it? No, not at all. It's actually kept my name alive, and I'm glad that he's done it and continues to do so. Mick and I are doing a comedy tour in Australia in July.
And, oh, that's awesome.
You know, because of that relationship and because of, you know, that where people seem to think that we, you know, are constantly at each other and, you know, after each other when we're not at all. It's just a gimmick. So, you know, like a lot of people, oh, you were a comedy wrestler. No, I wasn't a comedy wrestler, you Nimrod. I was insane. And therefore, I was able to do a lot of ridiculous things that other people couldn't do because it made sense because I was out of my mind. But it was entertaining, but I wasn't a comedy writer. I didn't do it for comedy's sake. I did it because the character was insane.
Right, so what you're telling me is that all of these people who are constantly shitting on Robbie, like, we see it all the time on the show and on Twitter, they're actually putting him over? Is that what's going on?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, because they're constantly putting his name out there in the public eye.
See that, Matt? Yeah. You know, I tried to tell Matt that, you know, everybody loves me and everything, and he just didn't believe it.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. that's like you know, that's like claiming that everybody loves a really hard case of influenza. You know, we're not going to enjoy that. That for you, Robbie, would be known as the flu. It's an illness, much like you are, a disease.
So. You know, Matt, do you know that me, Al, and Bruce Pritchard used to have conversations, and it would go on for, you know, sometimes 20, 30 minutes at a time, where we would just talk politics, all three of us, and they would ask me. Well, I think they were
how little you knew about it.
Oh no, it was a 50. Well, it wouldn't be 50-50. It was a 33 and a third conversation between the three of us, where we would just kind of give our views on the presidents and stuff.
Robbie, I convinced you that Alexander Graham Bell was our 26th president.
You know, it's so funny. Before you just said what you were going to say, I thought you were going to ask me who the president was, and I was about to say Obama, and then I remember that it's Trump.
I know. He didn't even know. He did not even know the presidents on the denominations of the bills. That's how all that got started.
So basically, it was you and Pritchard talking about politics and making fun of Robbie. That was what it was?
No, it was me and Pritchard trying to delve into the depths of the stupidity and see just how far it went down. And found out that the stupidity was a bomb as well. It just went on forever.
There's no metric, is there, Al?
No, there's no measuring it. You can, you know, it's one of those, you know, the end of the world type of things. You can throw a rock on it.
We'll get back to Al Snow in a minute, but I just want to point out two things to our friend Al, is that Robbie did very earnestly ask D'Lo Brown what a CPA was.
Oh, my God.
It's better. I have something better. He earnestly asked Matt Morgan what a blueprint was.
Okay, enough about me. Today's show is about Al, so keep going on. I actually have a real question that I want to ask. Al, I want to know, how did the whole...
What's ahead? What's ahead, Al?
Yeah, what's ahead?
How did the whole Tough Enough concept come about, and how did you, like, originally react to it, knowing that, you know, at that time, the business was still protected a lot more back then even. And, you know, how did, like, you go about, like, wanting to be, you know, training guys where everyone could see how training goes down and everything?
Well, I was approached by Kevin Dunn with this idea, and that it was with MTV. And he said that, you know, a big would speak to me. I'm like, what's a big? And then I met John Gabura. We're really great friends. I never taught those kids anything that would expose the business. I never taught them how to punch. And the reason I didn't was because when I first broke into business, you weren't taught to punch. You weren't taught strikes. You were taught to wrestle, and you were taught how to work with and move with someone else. And, between that and the fact that Big did a very good job of producing the show and working with the actors, and, all you really got out of it was, if you were a wrestling fan, a new appreciation for just how physically hard these kids worked.
Did you enjoy being the host?
I enjoyed, that was probably one of the greatest times I've had in professional wrestling was being a part of that. I really, really enjoyed that. Loved it. Just, it was all the good and none of the negativity. Because Robbie, you're around the boys. They can be so negative.
One thing about the Tough Enough experience for me as a fan, first of all, is the first time I ever saw a back bump being taught or how to flip over and land on your back. But the thing is that you ended up being the breakout star. And that's for not kids in your ass. That's me as a fan, because you look like you cared about these kids.
I did.
And it came through.
And here's why. Not because, everybody's I would use the term, they're my kids. And they were like, oh, you're such a great father figure, which was awesome. Because it got me over with women. But I use that term because that was a term from the wrestling business. When you were trained back in the day, when you were broke in, the guy who trained you was personally held responsible, accountable for everything you did in the business. And therefore, you were his kid. Now, I am 55, and I am still known as Jim Lancaster's kid in the business. And if I say or do anything, if some old timer hears it, he'll call Jim, and then guess who gets a phone call after that? And I have to explain to him, because I am still held accountable, because I still carry his name and his reputation around. And the same goes for these kids that were in that Tough Enough. They're mine. They belong to me. I'm responsible for them.
So it's more of an accountability than a mentorship.
Well, it's both. It's a mentorship too. I want to see, nothing thrills me more than to see every single person achieve their dreams and succeed. And, I want everybody to do as good as possible. But the real reason is that the more, as far as I tell guys all the time, when I was running the developmental program for OVW, for WWE, they would all be like, oh, you don't like me. Nothing can be further from the truth. I hate you. And the reason I hate you is because you now carry my name on you. And that means that I'm responsible for you. And nothing would thrill me more than for every single person that I've trained to go on to become mega superstar.
It's an evolution and an improvement off of the Gene Anderson, Ole Anderson model.
Me. Yeah. So it's a selfish thing, too. It's not an altruistic thing. I want to do everything I can to help every single person I can succeed. You know why? One, it makes me look awesome. Two, at the same time, the more of them that go out and succeed, the better the business is, and the more it not just survives but thrives, and the more it thrives, the more I can continue to make a living off a business I've been doing for as long as I've been doing it.
Now, the way you look at wrestling, all these things that you're saying right now, which I 100% agree with and always have, I think everything you say is 1,000% correct. But when do you think people stopped using that mentality of what you're talking about?
Because when they stopped having to do it for a living. When the majority of the wrestlers in the business no longer perform as a sole means of income, but perform, they work in that other job, and then they perform. And that's not taking anything away from them. They still have to bust their ass. They still want to succeed. They want to go out and, they still have to go out and hustle. They got to make towns. They got to pay their dues. But there's a different mindset when you know that the only way that you're going to be able to pay the electric bill is if you draw a good house.
So your success, or, however you feel about Tough Enough, I feel it was successful. I think it was a huge moment.
What
did it do to your wrestling career?
It could have catapulted my wrestling career, but again, I went back and still trying to be a good wrestler or a great wrestler and not being a great attraction and not using the push that Tough Enough gave me, using it myself to when I got on TV to capitalize on it and then build off of it and make myself a star.
It seemed like it stalled any momentum you had. And when you came back wrestling full time again, you were kind of on that decline and on your way out. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, yeah, I was on, yeah, because they had given me a couple of opportunities when I came back. And of course I didn't see them as opportunities and didn't utilize them.
What were they?
I don't, off the top of my head, I can't remember, but anytime I got out in the ring, that was an opportunity.
And then at this time, did someone come up to you and basically just approach you and ask if you'd be interested in being a head trainer of OVW?
Oh yeah. John Laurinaitis had asked me if I would be interested in doing that. And, you know, and I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's fine. You know, cause,
did you see that as the end of your wrestling
career? No, not really. But I did, at that time, I really cut back. I didn't wrestle because I'd really devoted. We were working at that time. We were working. When I first came down, I was still living in Ohio, and I'd drive down to Louisville, and I'd be down for 4 days, and I'd go back. So I'd still work on the weekends. I'd wrestle on the weekends wherever I could, but WWE wouldn't let you very often. Then as time went by and I moved down to Louisville and I really got involved, we got to the point, the year that we were shut down, they moved everybody to Florida. We ran 186 events. Wow. 52 of those were TV, the weekly TVs, and 134 of those were live events.
Plus you were writing all the shows, right? And training guys.
I was training the guys. I was writing the shows, producing the TV, directing it, doing all the aging and all the matches.
So in 2008, you know, WWE decided to consolidate developmental. Deep South goes. And then the way that you ended your career was that they ended the Ohio Valley Wrestling situation. And they said, well, no, Al, you're not going to Florida. That seems kind of fucked up to me. Is that the way you took it?
Nah. You know, it's a matter of when, not if, your run's going to end, especially in wrestling. So, you know, and when you've spent enough time in wrestling, you start to learn to look two and three moves ahead, because you're always playing chess or poker 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So you're always looking three steps or four, and I could see it coming.
You have that awesome attitude about it now, but at the time, were you resigned to it as well?
Nah, I didn't care. I should say I did care, and I didn't want it to happen because I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I felt like I was being, you know, was doing things well. You know what I mean? I was instrumental in getting a lot of guys contracts that deserved them, that new talent, helping develop them, and getting them ready. A lot of those guys are still up there. And girls too. Was really enjoying it. And then, you know, it came to an end. It's like, well, what do? I mean, now you just go and start working somewhere else.
So Al, you left, so WWE ended in 2008. And then what did you start with TNA in 2010?
I'm not real sure when I started with TNA, but I started, there as an agent, like on a trial run, and then was brought in and worked with all the girls primarily. That was my spot, was just to work with the girls.
And were you excited about it? Like, were you familiar with TNA at the time, or what was your thoughts when you first came?
I was looking forward to it, and it was an opportunity for me to do kind of what I was doing in OVW, kind of helping to lead and to instruct and do what I had not gotten when I was a talent, which was direction and an insight into what was really what, you know, the creative or the office really wanted out of your segment in a match. So I could help fill in those blanks and help direct you to where you could serve that purpose better, you know, and advise. I give advice now, you know, nobody would listen. They'd all look at me like, oh no, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, you're right. I haven't been you. So I've not made your mistakes. But I have, and actually I've made more than you, and you're probably not going to get the chance to make as many as I did. So, but don't listen to me. So.
Well, I know, you know, something we always ask is what you're up to now, but I know a couple of things you're up to now. First of all, I've been in contact with somebody over the last few months who's always asked me advice here and there, and I've given a little help here and there. And I think, Robbie, that Al Snow might be getting into the podcast game. Is that correct, Al?
Yeah, I've been pressured into it. I've been talked into it finally by your buddy Jarrett Orr. He was an awesome guy. He's an awesome producer. I didn't want to do it because it's like everybody has a podcast.
Who you tell?
You know, yeah, I mean, look, if there's one thing, wrestlers are like roaches. If you can put a pile of money in the kitchen floor and turn off lights, they all come scurrying out from underneath the cabinet. It's like, oh, podcast? Oh, comic book convention? They just, out they come, you know? And, oh, let's capitalize on this now. But he's talking to it, and we're giving it a go. And it's inside Al Snow's head. We just did another episode. And along with that, I have in the process and of acquiring OVW. I'm taking it over as the owner. Danny Davis is retiring, and I'm buying it from him. And, you know, we're 25 episodes away from the 1,000th consecutive broadcast television episode in November.
That's awesome.
And I'm, you know, I want to build up the school and build up the territory to where it was where, you know, we were running, like I said, 186. We ran 186 events with an average attendance of between 350 and 400 people.
Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, that's insane.
So,
is it a developmental slash promotion, or is it just a promotion? How are you approaching the new Al Snow era of OVW?
Well, it'll be a developmental because it'll be a place where, you know, guys can come and they can develop, get experience. They can get they can polish, and they can develop their that persona, that voice. You know, it will be from a standpoint that they're. I encourage them to come and make mistakes and screw up, and I'll sit right there and tell them, here's what you did wrong, here's what you should have done, here's why you should have done it, based on what we're selling. And, you know, they'll get an opportunity to truly understand what the wrestling business is and how to utilize TV to make themselves a star. I'm going to do everything I can to create as best a platform on the budget that I've got. You know, to give them the best presentation, to give them the best chance to make themselves a star. But it's up to them to make themselves a star. And that experience will be invaluable because once they get an opportunity elsewhere, like WWE or someplace like that, they'll really have an understanding that will allow them to capitalize on any opportunity they get.
And Al, if people want to follow you on Twitter, Instagram, reach out to you for bookings, do you want to drop any of that stuff, your social media, your email?
Sure. They can follow me at The Real Al Snow on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, because, yes, there were some fake ones. And I would message it, and I'm like, come on, guys, seriously? if you're going to fake being a celebrity, raise the bar. Okay, I don't even fake being me.
Hey, just let you know, there's some fake Robbies out there. I'm just saying.
Yeah, we're really now stretching on the limb, aren't we? But my email is info@therealalsnow.com, and I also have a wrestling clothing line called Collar and Elbow Brand. Which we do, and you can go to collarandelbowbrand.com. You can look at all the designs that we have, all the different clothing, and you can use my discount code, which is Snowman, which would take 10% off, or you can use any of the sponsored athletes that we have out there that have a discount code and help them, some of the independent wrestlers, make some money, like get a percentage, get 40% of the net profit for every article of clothing they sell if you use their code. And you can round up your purchase to the nearest dollar. That money is contributed to the Cauliflower Alley Club, who have had charitable efforts since 1950s until present day, where they help former wrestlers and boxers. We've contributed well over $1,000 just in the short time that we've been operating. We have a new military-inspired designs that a portion of the proceeds will be contributed to the American Legion that do incredible good works for our veterans who have served in the armed services. So you can check those out at collarandelbowbrand.com.
And don't sleep on that collarandelbowbrand.com, guys. I see wrestlers wearing that stuff all the time. And in case you didn't really kind of read between the lines of what he said, if you get the wrestler that you like, if you get their stuff from Collar and Elbow, they're getting a bigger cut of that than they will from other t-shirt companies. And also, round it up, and you could be joining the Cauliflower Alley's efforts, which are great, and you should definitely check Cauliflower Alley out online. Robbie, what else do you have to say? Al Snow said it all. I just want to thank Al for being here. Robbie, what do you think about our good friend Al Snow?
No, I appreciate you being on, and I'm glad. I thought there was going to be a lot more Robbie E. jokes throughout this. I thought he was going to hammer me a lot more. This was the nicest he's probably ever been to me in this amount of time, Matt. Can you believe that?
Well, maybe he decided to stop putting you over.
Well, that's because I didn't have to physically look at you. So, you know.
We could have done Skype video.
Oh, no, please. Yeah, it's bad enough for me to look at your dad bod destroyer pictures.
Thanks a lot, Al.
Hey, thanks for joining us, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Well, that definitely, guys, was Al Snow. Robbie, we learned a lot, and a lot of stuff I didn't know.
I am just honestly surprised that he didn't pick on me a lot more. I actually got off kind of easy, wouldn't you say?
I definitely, well, you know, yeah, I think at one point you did ask what a hooker was. But besides that,
No. You don't get it, though. This was easy. I mean, normally he's a lot tougher on me. This was a very easy night for me.
You know, one thing is I just listening to it again, I'm really mad at myself because Al at one point said his first match was in a 20-ring two-man battle royal, and that sounds fucking crazy, Robbie.
Well, that sounds crazy. In addition to, he's probably our only guest so far who trained so many years ago. He probably trained the earliest out of anyone. He's more of an old-timer, and it's just crazy to hear the experience he went through, how far he had to travel to get a tryout, all the calls he had to make just to go there and get beat up and then take a bus. You know what I mean? It was so different back then compared to some of the other stories. It really was bizarre hearing that.
And one thing that we want to tell everybody about and is that we are going to be in Chicago for All In Weekend. What do you think about us being a big part of StarCast?
Well, I mean, as you can see, clearly shaping up to be possibly one of the biggest wrestling weekends in history. And I don't mean that by numbers. I just mean that by buzz. Everybody is talking about it. I think every wrestling fan right now is talking about All In. It's going to be huge, so why wouldn't one of the hottest podcasts out there be a part of it, Matt? I mean, we're a thing now. You get it? We're a thing.
It's totally crazy, and when you see what we're going to do, it's even going to be crazier. It's a whole weekend of events. It starts on Thursday. On Thursday night, you might actually see me play some music with Frankie Kazarian and the Young Bucks' dad, Papa Buck. And then over the weekend, there might be some Wyatt-ended guests and some Wyatt-ended merch. And on Sunday, Wyatt-ended is the ending of StarCast. We're the last event.
Yeah, that sounds great, Matt. I mean, it's going to be crazy. But guys, check it. Just a reminder, again, don't forget YouTube, whereitended.com. Subscribe to us. When you're listening to our podcast, make sure every week you're leaving a 5-star rating. Subscribe if you haven't. Tell your friends. And then, of course, on Twitter, @WyattEnded, Instagram, @WyattEnded, and buy some merch at Pro Wrestling Tees. We got 4 different Wyatt-ended shirts going out there right now with more to come. And remember, tweet pictures of yourself in the shirts. You'll get a retweet. You'll get a follow. And keep spreading the word about us and let us know who you want next as a guest. We love your feedback.
The rule.